good attendance tonight. By the way, we had, I don't know, I'm sure it's not a record, but we had over 200 in both assemblies this morning. I think we had a total of 416 here this morning. So we're thankful for that and for our new families that are placing membership. We certainly welcome you and want to encourage you not to wait for somebody to come up to you and say, what would you like to do, but just jump right in here and say, hey, here's what I'd like to do. One of the real joys of being a part of this congregation is the inordinate amount of talent that is here, resident within all the folks here. It's just really incredible, and I've said this before, but you know, all the folks back where I came from, they want to know what classes I've taught since I've been here, and I said I hadn't taught any. And they said, how long have you been there? I said, well, a year and a half. They said, are you kidding me? I said, no, I'm not. And I said, besides that, every class that I have sat in, I have been really pleased to sit in that class, and I have learned in every one of those classes. It's not just filler. It's folks who have on their heart what they have studied and are studying and sharing that. I think most of you probably have traveled enough or been in enough congregations. You know that's not always the case. Sometimes, you know, you get in a class where somebody's just trying to fill up 40 minutes. And we don't have that here. And so it's that way when I've been in Marty's classes and Elton's classes and Nathan's classes and Dave's, and that's the four that I have set in since I've been here, one or two of them more than once. And each time it occurs to me how neat it is to be part of a team where folks are really working together. And I really felt that this morning in Dave's class. And I'm always sorry to see a quarter come to an end. I know the teacher's ready for a break, but I'm always sorry to see it come to an end. And whenever an acceptable amount of time has passed, you'll probably hear a few sermons from judges in the future, because I'm just sitting here writing sermon ideas, you know, while I'm in class. So it's a really, really neat thing. And then Sonny wasn't able to be with us, kind of a last-minute deal, and the pool of song leaders that we have is just incredible. And I know there are a bunch of you out there that are song leaders that you haven't let it be known yet, but even among those who are, we really have some incredible talent. And I really appreciate Corey and David and so many others stepping up at a moment's notice and doing such a fantastic job. So I'm really thrilled to be a part of folks who have so much talent that God has given you and your willingness to use that. And I want to thank you for that and know that I am encouraged by that, and I thank you for it. I'd like to use the life of the Apostle Paul to illustrate something that I think is kind of interesting, the difference between a life that is the result of living by law and a life that is a result of living by grace. There's a lot of teaching in the New Testament about a contrast between law and grace. There are lots of verses that we can quote and use, and hopefully we will in the future, to contrast that so that we'll have a clearer understanding. But occasionally, in fact regularly, we need to take the time to try to apply those things. It's one thing to have the head knowledge. It's one thing to know the verses. It's one thing to be able to defend the doctrine. It's something else to be able to put it into our life. And so as we make application of things that we learn, and I hope that things like, if you'll think back, we've had a series of lessons on learning to love like Christ learns to love. And I appreciate the things that people have said to me since then about some differences it's made in your life. And then we just finished a series on the anatomy of faith and talking about faith. And we're really, really spotlighting faith, because I really believe that that's where the heart of our relationship to God and our Christian walk is learning to trust God. And then as we think about grace and law, then I'd like to try to make an illustration of the difference, primarily from the life of the Apostle Paul tonight. Acts chapter 9 is a well-known chapter in the New Testament. It's the record of the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. Saul is his Jewish name, Paul is his Roman name, but the change in name is really not what's important in his story. His conversion is one of the most dramatic in Scripture. It could be called the transition from the persecutor to the persecuted, from a stickler for the letter of the law to a wonderful spirit of grace, for which he was very much maligned. His legacy in the Christian community since the very beginning changed from being one of the most feared men in Palestine to being, in later years, one of the most loved and appreciated. And in the Jewish community, he changed from being one of the most respected to being one of the most hated. And prior to his conversion, in his own words, "I laid waste the church of God." But afterwards, he built it up all over the Roman Empire and throughout the entire world to this very day. Today, he's still building up the Lord's church. Some writers have attributed Paul to being the chief promoter of Christianity, second only to Jesus Christ. Now, I'm not qualified to say that, but I wouldn't argue with it. We have more letters from his pen, obviously, than any other of the New Testament writers. It is the story of a successful turnaround from such a misplaced, misguided, legalistic zeal to a devoted Christian missionary to the Gentiles, the bulk of the world's population. And I'd like to show you tonight, if I am able to get across what I want to, something of an irony, or at least I consider it that way. Prior to his conversion, and it's going to be a little bit of a play on words, but I hope that it won't be too much of one. Prior to his conversion, Paul was a man armed with letters. Letters from the high priest. In Acts chapter 9, verse 1 and 2, it says, "And Saul, yet breathing out threatening and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord, went unto the high priest and desired of him letters to Damascus, to the synagogues, that if he found any of this way, whether they were men or women, he might bring them bound unto Jerusalem." And after the conversion account of Saul in chapter 9, there are two records that we have of Paul recounting this incident of his conversion to others. The first one is in Acts chapter 22, where he recounted it to the council in Jerusalem. And then again in Acts chapter 26, where he recounted it before Agrippa. And in this second account, Paul wrote that he, quote, "shut up many saints in prison, and when they were put to death, he cast his vote against them," in Acts chapter 26, verse 10. And these letters that he had in his possession were letters from the high priest, and they were similar to what we would call a warrant for someone's arrest today. A warrant had been sworn out against them, and he went to the authorities. He got their permission, and now he can go kick doors down. We still operate with some of that same type of thing today. You know, the officials cannot come into your domicile unless they have the authority from the proper government agency. And so he has these letters that are, in essence, the same as a warrant for someone's arrest. And in this case, those who were the objective of the warrant were all Christians who were of the way. It was, in effect, a death warrant, and it was open-ended. It didn't have names written in. There were blanks, as it were. And so anyone who was a Christian, simply being a Christian, was reason and cause for death. And it had begun in Acts chapter 7 with Stephen. And now there was a concerted effort You read in Acts chapter 7, continuing after that incident, there was a concerted effort to literally exterminate Christians. And it was led, among others, by Saul. Acts chapter 8, verse 2 says, Saul began to destroy the church. And to illustrate the extent of his zeal, this incident here in Acts chapter 9 is an illustration of how zealous he was, in fact. He was given these warrants from the authority of the high priest to bring these Christians back from Damascus for judgment. And when you say it real fast, you don't realize, or if you're not real familiar with your geography, you don't realize that Damascus was not in Israel. Damascus was in Syria, which is a northern neighbor. It's the capital city. It was not a part of Palestine. And so under Jewish law, Jews everywhere were under the authority of the high priest in Jerusalem. The authorities in Syria recognized the authority of these letters that he brought with him from the high priest, and their government allowed Saul to arrest and bind Christians, and today we would say extradite them to bring them across the border and bring them back to Jerusalem. Christians were dragged from cities outside Palestine to Jerusalem to stand trial and punishment if they refused to recant the way. And so, armed with proper papers, he journeys to Damascus. But you know the story. As they neared the city, something happened. The record says, as he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly there shined around about him a light from heaven. And he fell to the earth and heard a voice saying to him, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Acts chapter 9, verse 3 and 4. Consequently, instead of riding in the city with power and authority, he was led into the city by the hand, having been blinded by the light. And here's something I want you to notice. This is the beginning of what I want to say to you. I want you to see this irony here. After the light stopped he and his companions outside the city, the letters that he had with him, which represented the authority by which he was operating, are not mentioned again. They lost their importance in his life. And I've wondered what happened to those letters, because I feel pretty sure that he, as a leader of group, he had them in his possession. Maybe he kept them as a grim reminder of his former life, so that when he felt a need to, he might pull those out and realize what he had been and what he had done in his former life. Not really a parallel, but as close to a parallel as I can have in my life. I force myself to keep some sermons that I preached when I was a young preacher, when I was a young man. And I have, in going through at different times my files, run across some of those sermons, and I thought, did I really preach that? Did I really say that? Surely I didn't. And I want to throw it in the trash can and get rid of the evidence. But I make myself keep those. And the reason that I do is because there are times when I make myself pull those out, and it reminds me to be patient with people. Because I know there were some people who were very incredibly patient with me in those years particularly, and still are, I might add. And I'm thankful for you and your patience. But we do know that the light from heaven changed everything. The light from heaven represented life and giving one the ability to see clearly. The letters represented death and spiritual blindness. The letters, the arrest warrants, lost their power in the presence of the light. Now, I want to suggest to you tonight that some of us may be people of letters as opposed to people of light. The contrast between the letters and the light represents two completely different lives. Those of you who have been in my Romans class have heard me say that I view my own life very personally in two parts, before Romans and after Romans. I mean, it's that clear in my life, and my wife can attest to that. The contrast is that distinct. And the change in Paul's life was that very distinct. Saul was a classic product of the law. The law of Moses condemned anyone, and when you really understood it, everyone, you can accurately say, among the Jews for disobeying it. And those guilty of the law were stoned to death quite often. And you can read that penalty as it was legislated in Numbers chapter 15, beginning in verse 32. Saul did not understand at the time that the law was a schoolmaster to bring men to Christ. That was its purpose all along. But he will later understand that, and he'll write, "Do we then make void the law through faith? God forbid. Yea, we establish the law." And I think that is one of the most challenging statements as you're doctrinally studying the concept of law and grace that you might find, of how you illustrate that to someone. You look at the contrast among Jesus, or accepting Jesus Christ as a Messiah was in fact not a betrayal of the law, as the Jews felt like it was. It was the completion of the law. It was, in fact, the fulfillment of the law. And the law had done its job adequately when it brought someone to Christ. And you look at the contrast. Paul described the old covenant as the administration of death. But the new one was unto life. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 1 through 7. Paul said that God had made himself and his companions able ministers of the New Testament, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life, in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 6. Now I want you to listen to this. This contrast that he's making about life and death is literally illustrated the very day that the law was given. And I want you to think about this, being a person of the law, or a person with a letter, and a person of light. Like Saul of Tarsus coming down from Jerusalem with letters under his arm, Moses came down from Mount Sinai with letters under his arm. Now these letters were not written on paper. They were really serious. They were written on stone, on tablets of stone. And you don't know it yet when he's coming down from the law, coming down from the mountain with the law, with the letters. But somebody is about to die. He doesn't even know it yet. These letters carved into tablets of stone. It was the administration of death that Paul described to the Corinthians. It was in fact glorious, because the mountain looked like it was on fire and it smoked and it trembled, and there were lots of things associated with it that the writer of Hebrews will say that it certainly was something that was a fearsome sight. But it was the beginning of the administration of death. When Moses reached the bottom of the mount, he found the nation of Israel already worshiping a golden calf that Aaron had made for them. They were committing fornication. They were idolaters. And Moses commanded in Exodus chapter 32, and you can go there and read the details for yourself, commanded that they be put to death. Now let me show you something really ironic. That day, 3,000 men died. That day. You can read Exodus 32:28. The first day that the law was given, 3,000 died. Why? Because that new law said, when you sin, you die. And that will be the mantra of that law all the way through. When you sin, you die. Now, have you run ahead and picked up the irony yet? In Acts chapter 2, when the light came, a new covenant was given. You remember how many were saved that day? 3,000. Now, you can call that coincidence if you want to. I choose not to. I think it's really interesting. The first day that the law of Moses was given, 3,000 died. The first day that the light was shown, 3,000 were saved. What a contrast. The letters resulted in those dying, and the light resulted in those being saved. At the end of the Jewish period, light came from heaven and replaced the old letters in stone. The Apostle John used the analogy of light and darkness often in his letters. Listen to his contrast in John chapter 1. In him, speaking of Jesus, was life. And his life was the light of men. By the way, the last part of that bears some thought on your part. His life was the light of men. And dropping down to verse 9, that was the true light that lights every man that comes into the world. The law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. When the light came, the old letters were put aside. The power of death was broken. Listen to Paul's grand finale in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. At the conclusion of that incredible discourse on the resurrection, he says, death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your sting? In triumph, he gloats, what happened to your stinger, death? The sting of death, he continues, is sin. You see, that's how sin gets its poison, that's how death gets its poison in you, through sin. That's the bite, that's the stinger. And he says, and the power of sin is the law. Sin gains its power through the law. Paul will write to the Roman Christians, he said it took occasion, sin took advantage or took occasion of the commandment. And in me it wrought all manner of evil desire. And someday we'll look at that more completely. Verse 57 of 1 Corinthians 15, he says, Jesus pulled death's stinger. He says, thanks be to God, he gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. You know, there are lots of folks that feel like they've got things under control in their life. And I have to use this illustration from my childhood. There was a couple that lived near my grandparents, and my grandparents lived way, way out, long ways from any civilization. And I'm not saying they were uncivilized, but they didn't live real close to civilization, any town, anywhere. And there was an older couple that lived near them. And this older couple could not, neither of them could read or write. They were just salt of the earth kind of people, but they had absolutely no education whatsoever. But I loved them to death, and I loved to, you know, she was the greatest cook beside my grandma that there was. And so I loved to go over to their house. But I went over there one time, and they had a rattlesnake that one of them had found, and they had caught it. And they wanted to keep it. But they wanted to fix it so it wouldn't hurt them. And so they thought that tongue flicking out was what bit you. And so they took a pair of pliers and they got that snake, pinned it down, and they took his tongue and pulled his tongue out. And then they played with that snake. Now, they hadn't pulled the stinger. They thought they had, but they didn't have things under control like they thought they had under control. And I think maybe sometimes we think we have things under control when we really may not have them as under control as we think we do. Because we can't pull death's stinger. Only God can. And he did by the resurrection. For sin shall not have dominion over you, for you are not under law, but under grace. Romans 6:14. When the light came, it overpowered the letters, both in Moses' case and in Saul of Tarsus' case. And so now, Saul's life is empowered by the light and not the letters. Now, let's wrap this up. The contrast that you see between Saul of Tarsus and the Apostle Paul is a result of the difference between the letters, which would represent law, and the light, representing grace. The distinction between the letter and the light is the difference between, also the difference between outside and inside. When someone keeps saying, show me where it says in the Bible that I've got to do this, or it says that you are living by the letter rather than by the light. David wrote that the sacrifices that God desires are not burnt offerings, but a broken and contrite heart, Psalm 51:17. And today, I think it's very possible that Christians can fall in the same way, or can fail, excuse me, in the same way that Saul and the Pharisees did. We may have been immersed in water, yet be mean-spirited and unconverted. We may be faithfully breaking bread and drinking the cup, and yet trust in ourselves for righteousness rather than trusting in Jesus Christ. Some of the meanest people that I know are Christians who carry letters from the high priest under their arm, and they're looking to kill somebody. They've got a law. They're bent on destroying anyone and everyone who disagrees with them. And rather than that, let us delight in the law of God after the inward man. The contrast is so dramatic that Paul says, offer yourselves to God as those who have returned from death to life. That's the way that God wants us to see ourselves. And if it were within your power somehow that you literally went through death and you died and then you came back to life, I dare say you would be a different person. And that's the way that God wants us to view ourselves, as those who have returned from death to life, Romans 6:13. And so are you walking around with letters under your arm? Are you walking around with the freedom of God's glorious light? One brings death, the other life. Not only when the Lord returns, but right now. It makes a dramatic difference in your life, whether you are a person of the letters or a person of the light. It changes us from being insecure, legalistic, demanding, hostile, to being kind, loving, forgiving, happy, and encouraging people. It's a lot of difference in our lives. And if you're here and you're not a child of God, then you are at best a person of letters. You've got your authority under your arm, and you can show it to anybody, anywhere, anytime, and probably are willing to do that. Are you a person of the letters or a person of light, while we stand and sing?